Mostly cloudy tonight, a low around 28. Mostly sunny tomorrow, a little warmer. Tomorrow's high around 43. Expanded forecast, a chance of rain on Wednesday. Warmer, a high of 48. Partly sunny, dry for Thursday. Warmer still, a high of 51. Right now, 29. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, a look back at some of the greatest of the kings of ancient Egypt, five of the most notable pharaohs. In part two, the conversation that I recorded several years ago with the son of Gene Tunney, one of history's finest boxers. And the book we discuss is an intriguing look at Gene Tunney's friendship with George Bernard Shaw. Stay with us. Here's part one. This portion of WGTD's Morning Show is taken up with a fascinating topic, ancient Egypt, and in particular, five of its greatest rulers. The author of the book The Good Kings is Kara Cooney, a professor of Egyptian art and architecture at UCLA. And somebody who once upon a time was completely taken by the massive and dazzling splendors of ancient Egypt. But now she sees them in a very different light and sees them as representations of a terrible kind of authoritarian rule and sees very important lessons that can be drawn for us in the modern age. The full title of the book is The Good Kings, Absolute Power in Ancient Egypt and the Modern World, and the book is published by National Geographic. So I'd like you to explain an interesting turn of phrase at the very top of the book's first chapter when you say, "I am a recovering Egyptologist." Explain the drastic shift that has gone on in your sort of mind and heart when it comes to ancient Egypt.
I still think it's crazy. I put that down on paper, and I tried to bury it. And my editor was like, nope, that needs to be the first sentence. I'm like, no, don't make me do it. But it's there. So essentially, I'm saying that I was a celebratory participant in the beauty that the pharaohs were able to create, and I was uncritical. And I looked at it from an aesthetic perspective, from a perspective that centralization was better government. And I need to reshape all of my own assumptions about what kinds of human systems people want to live under, and not just look for the beauty of a statue or a temple, though they are beautiful things.
You write at one point that unassailable strength of ancient rule, once so attractive to me, has now soured. And the next sentence is so intriguing. You say the realization of that was like suddenly understanding that you're in an abusive relationship. So in a sense, it sounds like you are likening the relationship between those all-powerful ancient pharaohs and their peoples as, in a sense, an abusive relationship, or at least there was that facet to it.
No, I do put it into exactly that rubric, and I feel it that way, and I think a lot of us feel exactly that. And my own abusive relationship past aside, let me put it into the lens of my own university world, right? Training to be a professor and then entering the academy and seeing that all of the jobs that used to be long-term jobs are short-term adjunct positions, and all of the students that I'm training are training for nothing but, you know, one class here, one class there, and they can barely put together a living. And all of us are doing a gig economy. All of us are Uber drivers. And so all of the systems that we may have grown up idolizing and thinking would protect us and thinking would serve us, we have to look at them with so much dubious side eye, because all of them are exploiting us within an inch of their lives such that we're working two or three jobs. So it doesn't matter what toxic relationship you're in. I'm sure you're in at least a few. Everyone who's listening here doesn't have to be a marriage, but so many of the things that we thought would work are not working, and we can see that the system is a pay-to-play system in which the top 1% is running things, and Jeff Bezos has $300 billion.
Hmm. You write at one point, ancient Egypt can help us understand why we so easily bend toward authoritarianism, why it attracts and comforts us. Is there a simple, short answer to that that question?
Yeah, Egypt, when you look at it, you see weird crowns and weird sticks and staves, and you're like, we would never believe in God kings, that's so stupid. But they were embedded in that religion in that way. For them, it wasn't weird. It was their Northeast African way, and it worked on their minds. On our minds, we have divinized leaders like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson or JFK, and we don't disassociate, but we idealize everything. And I would actually argue that the biggest ideology, the biggest hoodwinking, the man behind the curtain, so to speak, is that we live in a democracy at all, because our pay-to-play system is not an actual representative democracy of what the majority of people want. It is minority rule, and it's minority rule of those with the most money. And we tell ourselves lies all the time about how we live in this ideal democratic system, and we say that we're better than a place like Russia or China. And I'm here trying to break down those barriers between Egypt and the modern world, or the United States and other places, and saying these are all patriarchies. They all work the same way. We all live in the same system. And if we're going to get out of that system, we have to see it for what it is.
You put into interesting perspective the matter of time, the immense span of time that separates us from ancient Egypt. And although in some ways that has to be some source of frustration for you and other historians and Egyptologists, you also see it as a positive in terms of the analysis you're doing. You write, the millennia that separate us from ancient Egypt's authoritarian regimes are a gift. Studying this archaic culture transports us to a world of pharaohs and harems and pyramids, all coated in a delicious golden shell. It allows us to investigate a political system with sobriety and distance, and even some patronizing judgment. So in other words, if there wasn't quite that expanse of time between us, we wouldn't be able to, in a sense, see that regime with such clarity. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly what I'm saying. Let me put it this way. If you're swimming in the water, can you see the water? Do you look at the water? If you're embedded in a system, you don't see what's actually happening in the very system that you're working with. It's hard to see what you live in. And Egypt, it is that gift, because not only do we have the time separating us, but it gives us 3,000 years of ups and downs. We're living in a system of 250 years, and we think it could go on forever. For an Egyptologist, 250 years is a blip on the radar. It's nothing. And we need to start seeing it as such, that we do live in a system that can change and change rapidly. And to have an idea of what hyper-centralization can create and what patriarchal hyper-hoarding can create, we need to see what the downfall of that is. And Egypt does give us that down. It gives us the upswing, and it gives us the downturn. And so we can see what's coming, in a sense. But then, I also look forward even further, and I say, well, what's after patriarchy itself? And there, you know, I'm a historian. I have the last chapter, which is trying to prognosticate a post-patriarchal reality, but nobody knows. I can't read the future.
Right. Your book, most of your book is actually devoted to examining the legacies of five of the great ancient Egyptian rulers or pharaohs. Why these particular five?
These five, and the five are Khufu, Sinwasser III, Akhenaten, Ramses II, and Taharqa. They come from a broad span of time. They're representative of very different systems, but each one, patriarchal systems, but different types of patriarchy, so lest I be misunderstood. But they're all from the top of the wave, if you like. If history is moments of centralization and great spending, and you're there at the top of the bell curve, there will be a fall. The wave will crest, and things will fall into decentralization and a lack of building. And each of these kings, in the time that they were ruling, people thought, must have thought, well, this will go on forever. We'll have this system of rule forever, not realizing that that hyper-centralization and amount of building was sowing the seeds for a demise that would happen very quickly. And in each case, those kings lose their dynastic, well, not those kings themselves in every case, but one. But within a few generations, it's gone. And what I'm trying to bring with this book is a long-duration look. Humans are so good at thinking short-term. We see what's going to happen today, tomorrow. But to understand history in 250, 500-year, 1,000-year, 2,000-year chunks is something that we're not very good at. And that's what Egypt gives us, and that's what I do. And so it's like, okay, I'm an American in this 250-year system. What does that mean? How can we understand it? And so by putting it in comparison to Egypt, it makes you realize how little perspective we actually have.
One last quick question, one specific instance I thought was so interesting. In the earliest of these five rulers, Khufu, who was responsible for building the Great Pyramid, or saw to it that it was built on his behalf, you say that in some ways it is a sign of a king's absolute power, but it's also a sign of his weakness. Briefly, I'm afraid, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's so interesting. You see a pyramid and you're like, well, he built it because he could, because he's so powerful. He's the god king. But he builds it because he has to. He builds it because the Egyptian kingship had become so weakened that it needed a little oomph. It needed a little repackaging to show how powerful it was. And make no mistake, what Khufu was able to do did repackage the kingship, and it still works on our simple minds today, such that when we look at these pyramids, we think they can't possibly have been built by normal humans, and we have all these TV shows about ancient aliens and things like that. If Khufu was able to look down from wherever he is, he would say, ha-ha, that's exactly what I wanted you to believe. So it still works. But by building that pyramid, he forever enfeebled his own kingship, because to build it, he had to empower a class of engineers and inventors and pay them a good deal of money. He created a super elite that took the king's power away for generations thereafter by trying to create his own superhuman kingship. Hmm.
The book, again, is The Good King's Absolute Power in Ancient Egypt and the Modern World, published by National Geographic. Kara Cooney, thank you so much for giving the world this fascinating book.
Thanks for having me on.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. I am so honored that for the next few minutes, I speak with Jay Tunney, and that last name is a famous name in the annals of boxing. Jay Tunney's father was James Joseph Gene Tunney, and he was world heavyweight boxing champion in the mid-1920s. In fact, he defeated the legendary Jack Dempsey twice. And Gene Tunney was much more than a superb boxer. He was also a great gentleman and a learned man, and someone who, at the height of his fame, was one of the best known men in the entire world. And just after his retirement from professional boxing, Gene Tunney crossed paths with another very, very famous learned man, George Bernard Shaw. And a book which has been written by Jay Tunney, one of Gene Tunney's sons, explores in particular the unlikely friendship between these two gentlemen. An unlikely friendship, really not at all, because when it comes to what was important to these two men, in fact, there was every reason for them to be the best of friends. And indeed, although some 40 years separated them in age, they were good friends over the course of two decades, right up to the end of George Bernard Shaw's life. And in this fascinating new book called The Prize Fighter and the Playwright, we learn a great deal more about these two men and about their warm friendship and their regard for one another. The book is published by Firefly Books, and it includes a number of very, very interesting photographs, many of which have never been published before. And again, I am so honored to be speaking for the next few minutes with one of the sons of Gene Tunney and the author of this book. Jay Tunney, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg, very much. It's a pleasant to be here.
Tell us first, just if you would, a word about what it was like to grow up the son of such a famous father. What was that like for you and for your siblings?
Well, actually, it may have been a little different the way we did it than the children of other celebrities. One thinks immediately of the West Coast when we say that. Children of many of those celebrities have a harder time. I don't quite know why. But I think that Dad went out of his way to make sure that we were treated as normally as possible. And therefore, he led a quiet life himself in a rather a non-public life after he retired from the ring. And tried to become a normal citizen after that, as by way of being somewhat of a writer and also a businessman. And his wife and he wanted it that way, and they produced four children, and we were really quite normal. I never thought of myself really as a celebrity son, particularly most of my teenage life, until I really got away from home. When I was about 18, did I ever really feel that way? But that was my mother and dad's choice, personal choice. They knew what they were doing on that score.
So tell us to what extent you felt temptation to follow in your father's footsteps when there were such different footsteps to follow. I mean, you could have emulated your father in several different respects because, of course, he was this fascinating, multifaceted Renaissance man. What did you feel like you most wanted to emulate in your famous father?
Perhaps just exactly that, kind of a Renaissance man. That's quite a playful. I didn't really start thinking in that way until later in my life, until I was in my 50s. Maybe that's a little late, but I was always an entrepreneur and in business and in politics, which I spent a bit of time in. And I always felt I had a solo act going. And I did, and I was over in Asia for, you know, the better part of 18 years, 20 years, putting together challenging new frontiers in South Korea by bringing them premium ice cream over there for the first time, and then being a shipping man out of Hong Kong with a Chinese partner, ship owner partner. And I did a lot of things like that, and even drilled or explored. I didn't drill, actually, but I explored for oil in Burma before it was Myanmar back in early 1970s. And I got a good taste of what it was like to be lonely and be out there by yourself. And I suppose that, in a sense, was being a Renaissance man. I had been in politics in California, too, helping my brother at one time become United States Senator back in 1970. And I had these experiences, and I'd lived in other countries beside the United States, and it was a very broadening feeling, a very broadening effect on me and my personality. And it allowed me, I think, in the end, to finally step into writing a book about Dad, this book, and about Shaw, and understand a lot more now that I could have been, I could have before, had I tried a shot at it 30 years ago or so when I didn't know as much. And so I think this is what I got from Dad more than anything. It was kind of challenging new frontiers always.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the genesis of this book. I mean, is this something you have considered doing for a long time? And is there any particular reason why now this book appears?
Well, it's something that was cropping and developing in my own mind, and in also my mother's mind, and a good friend of the family, a former ambassador to Sweden, Mr. Frank Forsberg, from Connecticut, and he was a great friend of Dad's, and he wanted to see a good story, a very good story written about Dad by somebody who really knew Gene Tunney. And I think maybe 12 years ago, my mother was showing that same side to her that she would have liked to have seen me try to take a shot at Dad and write about him as somebody that really knew who he was and had that advantage. And so that's where it really, it's been cropping up. It's been coming for the last 20 years, I think, 25 years. There has been a book written about him, maybe one or two books, actually, but none by somebody that could get under Dad's skin, so to speak. And that's basically it. And my mother approved it and liked the angle I was taking on doing a book on Sean and Tunney, which revealed a side to Dad that most people never really knew much about.
Hmm.
And yeah.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Jay Tunney. And Jay Tunney's father, Gene Tunney, was heavyweight boxing champion of the world. And, of course, a participant in one of the most famous boxing matches in history. The book explores that and more, but the sort of unique angle of this particular book, written by Jay Tunney, is of his father's friendship with George Bernard Shaw. Mr. Tunney, how did you go about writing this book in terms of learning even more about your father and his life and this friendship with Mr. Shaw? I mean, learning even more than you already knew, just as, of course, one of his children and as a member of this family. To what sort of resources did you turn to deepen your understanding of your father?
Well, there are a few answers to that. The main one being we had our own archive here, our own library, in my mother's and father's home in Stamford, Connecticut. And I was able to, with great resolve, dig into all that. There were many communications between Shaw and Dad, and there were all the plays and writings, the essays, many of the essays Dad had in his library there that Mother became the custodian of after Dad's death in 1978. And she was able to direct me and help me and with all kinds of things, became a primary source. And that was very important to me, and her takes and on things that had to do with Dad and Shaw way back at that period of time were very important to the book, because it gave me allowed me to be there and be present at the scene, so to speak. I had no tapes or anything like that for a period that happened 80, 85 years ago. And so that was very, very important to me. And then the other, to get a grasp on Shaw from not just my family's point of view, but from Shaw's point of view, I have become very close to the Shaw Society, the International Shaw Society, and the Shaw Festival, particularly up in Canada, in Ontario, Canada. Niagara on the Lake. There's a wonderful repertory theater there that does called the Shaw Festival, and it concentrates on Bernard Shaw's plays. And I have become on the board up there and become a great advocate of the professionalism of that place. And I go up, and my wife and I are up there all the time, and I've learned tremendous amounts about George Bernard Shaw from that experience of the last 10 years.
One of the things that is most intriguing about your father and what he and your mother experienced during their courtship and honeymoon was just how incredibly famous they were. And
yeah.
For all the ways in which we might find disquieting the media scrutiny that celebrities undergo today, and the paparazzi trailing them wherever they go, in a sense, your parents experienced all of that and more. And I suspect that as you did your research, you came to probably an even more profound appreciation for just how glaring the spotlight was for these two young adults.
Well, it's very true, Greg. I mean, shockingly so, as a matter of fact, particularly with the way, when one considers the way we were brought up, which is a certain amount of privacy. But there was a tremendous blast of publicity at that time. I guess it had something to do with the invention of radio at just that time, right in the middle of the 1920s, the swinging 20s. And radio, the early crystal sets, and then the radio came into being, and just broadcasting to tens of millions of people that had never happened before, that people could get in on the show right there as it was underway, and then 60 million people were listening to Dempsey and Tunney at that time, the 1927-1926 period. And my gosh, all of a sudden Gene Tunney's name and Jack Dempsey's name was all over the world. They were well known. That was the first in history that there was such a gigantic amount of publicity and fame that spread so quickly. So Dad suddenly found himself as one of the most lionized men in the world. and practically could go anywhere, and somebody would have known all about him and treated him in an innocent way like a real hero. None of the cynicism had yet been able to start in. That took at least another 60 years for that to happen, but with television and everything coming on after that. But the innocence of it was what was so tremendous, of true no heroism, simply because they were celebrities of that moment. And
your father, of course, came to prominence at the time that Jack Dempsey was still around, one of the most famous boxers in all of history. And, of course, the two of them were so different from one another, or at least in some very obvious ways were different. Perhaps they shared some similarities beneath the surface, but they were in some respects the Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe of their day. I mean, that I'm a tennis fan, so that kind of rivalry between different opponents is what springs to my mind, and others would come up with probably other similar duels in other sports. Talk for a moment about the startling contrast between them and what the public sort of made of your father, I mean, compared to the much more sort of down-to-earth Jack Dempsey.
Well, that's correctly phrased. He was more down-to-earth than my dad, and they were very different types altogether. They both came from more or less the same same home front, where there wasn't a lot of money and things. They had to work for everything they got, and both of them did, but they took dramatically different methods or ways of getting on and getting ahead in life. And they were, Dad was a city boy, really, from New York City, Greenwich Village, New York, and had maybe what goes with that, being a city boy, a certain, I shouldn't say delicacy, but a more refined way of looking at things. Jack was out there in wild Colorado in the country, in the mountains, and they breed them a little rougher and tougher, I think, out there. And I think their personalities reflected that to a large extent. Jack Dempsey would have made a beautiful politician. He was fantastic with people. Dad was a little bit more reserved with people, although Dad could be unreserved when he wanted to be in the right setting. He was altogether as friendly and as pleasant with people as Jack always was. But I think Jack approached boxing from what we would call a bit of a hackneyed phrase, the man killer approach. And Dad was more of a, should we say, a mental approach or a scientific approach. And that, I guess those two approaches differ in the way that Jack had a wicked punch, and he counted on that punch to do the damage for him to his opponents, and felt that whenever he could call on his beautiful, fantastic left hook or his right cross, that he could do it. Dad didn't approach it that way. Dad knew that his punches were not maybe as powerful as Jack Dempsey, but he had to depend on quickness of movement, in and out, blocking, ducking, and countering. And these were his points of strength. And he had a way of wearing his opponents down. Dad made sure he got in top physical condition all the time, more than any other fighter, practically, of his century. And he just wore them down and punished them constantly, slicing, cutting, and things like that. And before you knew it, their eyes were bleeding all over the place.
You know, one of the photographs that I had never seen before, I I so appreciate it because without a single word, it tells us something about your dad as a boxer. It is another photograph of him on the mat, the only time he was knocked down in any of his fights, right, in that famous long count with Jack Dempsey.
Yes.
And, I mean, most of us have seen the famous photograph where we're looking at your dad from the front, and he's, of course, on the mat and looking up at the ref, and he's just looks there, just kind of like a sack of flour sprawled on the floor. But your book has a photograph I've never seen before of the same moment, but from the back.
Yes.
And we see your father's incredibly powerful shoulders. And it's just amazing. He looks like an entirely different kind of physical specimen. And a little bit later in the book, we see a photograph from later in that fight. And by this point, he's pummeling Jack Dempsey, who has completely worn out. And your father looks utterly invincible. I so appreciated the opportunity to kind of have these different views of this famous moment in boxing history.
Well, you bring out a very good point, Greg, because Dad had been building himself up more and more as the 20s went on, as he became heavyweight champion in 1926. And actually, the power that he had in his muscles, his arms, his shoulders, by the time he met Jack Dempsey, was practically, probably as great as Jack Dempsey himself. And what people forget is Dad had 45 KOs. He won 77 fights, but he knocked out 45 people. And people keep forgetting that and not knowing that point. It's just something that just isn't brought out very much. But he was a real fighter. He wasn't just a feather duster, as the sports men like to say or call him. And particularly the sports casters and the sports writers gave that impression. But it was actually a wrong. At first, it was the right impression, but the last 3 or 4 years, it was a wrong impression.
So we need to spend at least a couple of minutes talking about this friendship between Gene Tunney and George Bernard Shaw. One of the things that made it not as unlikely as it might seem at a glance is that George Bernard Shaw, long before your father came along, had been quite interested in boxing.
That's very true. He actually got an interest in it right away after he emigrated from Ireland to England at the age of 20, back in about 1876, and he ran into another Irish immigrant who was living very near him in London, a fellow called Paquito Beatty, and Beatty persuaded him. Beatty was a poet, but he was a passionate poet and a great fan of boxing. It was one of the great sports he felt at that time, and he got Shaw interested in it. And together they worked out at the gym, and they had a bit of time in the ring, and Shaw actually did get in the ring, and not often. Let's not overdo that, but he certainly got to know boxing. He went to many fights, and he got to know the sport as well as any writer who ever lived.
The moment that they befriended one another came in some ways at the height of your father's fame, although at that point he had retired from professional boxing. And George Bernard Shaw, just a couple of years earlier, had won the Nobel Prize.
That's correct, in 26.
So one of the things your book suggests is that aside from just sort of shared interests, your father and George Bernard Shaw also had in common this sort of extraordinary name recognition and fame. And probably this in and of itself was another bond for them.
Well, I think so. You know, there were a couple of celebrities and a couple of winners. And you have to have a mutual admiration for each other for that. You know, it's just that doesn't last long if you don't have anything beyond that. And I think what the interesting thing about my story and about what actually was that Dad and Shaw had developed a much stronger friendship than just the surface celebrity. It was during that period, started in 26, when they met through Shaw's novel, Cashel Byron's Profession, and they didn't meet until 1928, until Dad retired from the ring. That was the initial kickoff, was really that novel that Hollywood wanted to make a movie out of. In 1926, when Dad was champion, they wanted Dad as the lead role, Cashel Byron. So they cabled Shaw to see if he wanted to do it, and he didn't particularly want to do it, and he was a little rude about it. And in typical Shavian fashion, he just simply didn't answer. And but it never got off the ground, and Dad had said one or two nasty things about the book, and then Shaw gave with the punch a little bit, realizing what he had in Dad's remarks. But they got to know each other that way through Cashel Byron's Profession, this boxing novel that Shaw wrote in 1882. And a very interesting book. But anyway, after they did meet, the boxing became a very pivotal part of their relationship. Shaw admired a champion, and of course, Dad admired a great giant of literature, admired it tremendously. And so they really clicked from that point of view, from those two points of view.
One of the things you talk about in characterizing this friendship, and maybe it's true of some of the other friendships that your father had with people like F. Scott Fitzgerald and H. G. Wells and Ernest Hemingway and so on, is the fact that often in these friendships, your father would want to talk about literature. Their world, in a sense,
right.
And they would want to talk about boxing, his world, and it kind of got me thinking about how intriguing such friendships can be, and also probably to some extent potentially awkward in terms of what are we here for, what are we going to talk about today over this meal we're about to share.
Well, it just depends how well you can talk about the other fellow's field of endeavor and expertise. Dad was really good at that. He was as you mentioned earlier, an autodidact, which means a self-educated man, ferociously self-educated. And he knew a great deal about life and about things, maybe just as much as F. Scott Fitzgerald did. And so Dad had the same sensitive type nature, delicate sensibilities, that Fitzgerald had. And one felt in another lifetime Gene Tunney could have easily been a writer if he had really turned his mind to that instead of spending a lot of it on boxing. The first 13 years of his career were boxing. And so I don't think Dad had trouble. That's why they liked Dad, the boxer. That's why Thornton Wilder loved to have Dad around, because they simply spoke the same language. Even though Thornton Wilder couldn't talk about boxing all that much the way Hemingway could. Hemingway could really talk your head off about boxing. Fitzgerald would have liked to have done that. Fitzgerald was just happy to be around Dad as a boxer. He was always thrilled about it. He wasn't around him all that much, but not the way Hemingway was, and the way Thornton Wilder was, and the way Shaw was. But usually it was boxing that was the key, that was the nexus that brings these fellas together. Boxing was a famous sport. It was the sport in those days. You've got to remember. People don't recall that now. There wasn't any basketball to speak of. The only other sport was really baseball and football, of course, but not nearly to the extent that boxing was. And it was really king in those days. And so that's how that worked. And Dad was one of the first around to show that he wasn't a bonehead or something, because I think the caricature was boxers and fighters are all boneheads, and Dad showed he wasn't that at all.
to say the least.
And just because he wasn't a bonehead didn't mean he was a freak either. And so this was always a bone of contention.
Right. It's so interesting to think about, I mean, trying to imagine nowadays a heavyweight boxing champion or any kind of boxing champion going to Yale University and lecturing on a Shakespeare play without notes for 45 minutes, as your father did. I mean,
I agree.
Whoa.
I agree. Oh, yes. It's really something. That was William Lyon Phelps who invited him. He was the head of the English department there at Yale, and he invited Dad and gotten to know him in Florida. And they'd gone to one of the training camps where Dad was, and then they got a golf game together, and he invited him. And my gosh, it was one of the made Phelps one of the most famous professors in the world, and Dad too became really famous because of this connection to Yale and Shakespeare. Really, really remarkable.
The last question I want to pose to you, we have just a moment or two, I'm afraid, for the answer. At one point, George Bernard Shaw is quoted as saying, "Gene Tunney helped me to plant my feet on solid ground." That was at least one of the ways in which he appreciated his friendship with your father. In what way do you think your father helped George Bernard Shaw plant his feet on solid ground? What was Mr. Shaw talking about?
Shaw's world was the theater, and often in the theater you find fancifulness. In fact, maybe that's its stock in trade. There is fantasy, and many people go into the theater just for that purpose, to kind of get away from reality, so to speak, the reality of life. And I think Shaw was the people that he saw and hung around with to a large extent were people from the theater. I think other playwrights and directors and actors, particularly actors and actresses, and they'll find people, they live in a bit of another world. And I think when Dad stepped, came around Shaw, there was a great a tremendous feeling of a real person being in Shaw's midst for a brief time when Dad would come to visit a day in St. Lawrence or in Venice or Brioni, where they were. And there was a sense that this was a real champion, a real person who had done real things. And I think that's what that expression was meant. And he talked like a real person, and he wasn't a put-on. Dad was not a put-on. Shaw admired that ingenuous quality of Dad's.
That and many more insights found in this fascinating book called The Prize Fighter and the Playwright, Gene Tunney and George Bernard Shaw. This book, generously pointed with photographs, many of them you likely have never seen before. The book is published by Firefly Books, and its author, Jay Tunney. Jay Tunney, I thank you so much for this privilege and honor of speaking with you, and thank you for writing such a fine book.
Thank you so much, Craig. It's my pleasure, believe me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm going to be speaking with Brian Gill. I'm going to be speaking with Brian Gill from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside Theater Faculty about the play, The Thanksgiving Play. which is an intriguing look at the Thanksgiving holiday and political correctness. And in part two of tomorrow's morning show, I'm going to be speaking with Lisa Konetsky from a conversation in 2019 in which she discusses Sarah Ruhl's award-winning play, Eurydice. That was actually Lisa Konetsky's final production at Parkside ahead of her retirement. I want to replay that conversation because this play has been adapted into a brand new opera that can be seen this Saturday at 12 noon in HD simulcast in theaters across the country, including the Renaissance in Racine and Tinseltown in Kenosha. So Brian Gill and Lisa Konetsky on the Tuesday morning show.